How the hell did we get here?
He just seems like a spineless wimp who cares more about his position.
DNC plant?
That's what I think. I think he's central casting.
It was the same type of thing that you saw during COVID. Don't do your own research.
Yes.
Don't question authority. Just go along with what the man on the TV says.
It's a deliberate part of the plan.
What do you think about us manipulating the weather?
The guys like Bill Gates say, well, I buy carbon offsets. Isn't that like Jeffrey Epstein saying, I buy rape offsets? Like.
Good to go?
We're good to go.
Oh, we're good to go. Okay. We have a very special guest with us today. Or should we say we have a very special show because we have a very special guest with us today. He is a podcaster, a comedian, political commentator, rebel. Some say that he's a left-wing socialist. Some call him a right-wing pipeline fascist figure. I say that he is probably one of the most fearless anti-establishment voices out here. Jimmy Dore.
Wow. Well, that's a nice introduction. I appreciate you saying that, James. Thank
you. Oh, yeah. I mean, hopefully, yeah. I was, you know, we got to gas you up a little bit to
begin
with. And I have to say, because I discovered you back in 2015, I have to admit that you were probably, I would say, at least partially, if not fully responsible for my political awakening / blackpilling a little bit during the Bernie Sanders first campaign. And now here we are sitting down like 10 years later. We've elected twice a casino mob boss kind of guy, which is some people say it's good. Some people don't like that. We've also elected another guy who is dead almost. So how the hell did we get here?
We got here because Bernie Sanders had control of half the Democratic Party in 2016. And he decided to... And so he had a lot of leverage, and he decided to not use any of it. And that's what happens.
Well, why not?
So this is the result of it. I can't get inside Bernie's head. I could just theorize, you know, he just seems like a spineless wimp who cares more about his position. He doesn't want to end up like Ralph Nader, right? So that's a direct quote. He said that to Chris Hedges. And I think Jesse Ventura, I said it to Chris Hedges when Chris Hedges asked him to run third party, him and Shama Sawan, I think it was. And he said, I don't want to end up like Ralph Nader. So that's a pretty cowardly thing, especially when you have that kind of leverage and power. And, you know, we didn't ask for much, you know, we just asked him to, hey, how about you get corporate money out of the primary? How about you get rid of superdelegates? How about you demand something? How about you demand that they, you know, have a vote for Medicare for all? How about you demand a minimum wage rate? How about you demand something? He did nothing. Both times. Demanded nothing. And didn't even make them change, you know, pay a price for cheating him, which they did. And, you know, they've tried to rewrite, you know, the Elizabeth Warren famously on CNN said, yes, that the primary was rigged. Donna Brazile wrote about it in her book.
She also called him a secret sexist.
You mean Elizabeth Warren? You
called Bernie a secret sexist. Yeah. Which is...
And absurd. So that's... Yeah, so, you know, that's why, like, a lot of those terms don't land anymore because people have overused them, right? Racist, sexist, fascist. That's a hot one.
Well, you're all of them combined.
And, yeah. And they said his followers, Bernie Sanders' followers, where they were Bernie bros, they were violent, white, sexists, and racists, right? So that's... And then they tried to throw that on Donald Trump. Immediately after the primary. And so that's the game they play. And I think enough people have woken up to that game. And so that's how we got here, by the way. And so my whole thing was always, you know, people were freaked out and they hated on Donald Trump. Whereas I was like, why aren't you angrier at the system that gave you Donald Trump, right? If you hate Donald Trump so much, how did we get here? Why did so many people who voted for Bernie Sanders vote for Donald Trump? And why? And, you know, Michael Moore knows. He knew that. He warned them in 2016 that this was happening. People were felt screwed over by the establishment, and because they were. And, you know, there was never a reckoning for the financial crash in 2008. You know, Barack Obama kicked 5.1 million families out of their homes while he made sure the bankers kept their kept their bonuses. He told the bankers, I'm the only thing standing between you and the mob. I'm here to protect you. And so he did. So he protected. And that's when we had the Tea Party and we had Occupy Wall Street. And they were both complaining about the same thing. And so that's when the intelligence community went in and did psyops and had to figure out a way to divide us, right? So we couldn't come back together along economic lines. And that's when the mentions of racism skyrocketed. I saw Michael Schellenberger do a presentation on this about how that just all of a sudden everything was white supremacist, everything was racist. So that was their way to divide the country again. And that's what they need. They need the country divided. It's the oldest trick in the book. It's divide and conquer. And so that's how we got here. That's how we got. And so Barack Obama went on to give us, he said, I wouldn't give you a healthcare plan, I promise, without a public option, which is the ability to buy into Medicare. And he said, I will not sign one without that. He signed one without that. He said, my first order of business is as I'm going to codify Roe versus Wade into law. And when he got elected, they asked him, I thought that was the first thing you're going to do. He goes, that's not important to us right now. He gave us a right-wing healthcare plan that came out of the Heritage Foundation. Guess what else came out of the Heritage Foundation? Project 2025. So then he went on to do Libya, expand the war in Afghanistan. He did the dirty war in Syria, imprisoned Chelsea Manning, all that kind of stuff, that never prosecuted the people who did Iraq or did the torture program. So that's how we got here. So I would always try, you know, I would see comedians who I love, like Jim Gaffigan, who's hilarious, and he was his moral conscience. He had to talk out about Trump, right? And so I was trying to encourage people like that. Why don't you talk out about why we got Donald Trump? What led to that? Because if Barack Obama, after 8 years of Barack Obama, the country goes, that overwhelmingly elected Barack Obama twice, all of a sudden says, yeah, you know, I want to vote for a real estate game show host who everybody says is a racist. All of a sudden, why would that doesn't make any sense. So why don't you look at the actual problem? And the actual problem is we have a uniparty, which is why Trump rolled through the primary, because he was running against the Democratic Party, just like Bernie Sanders was running against the Democratic Party. And that's why they were so popular and had such populist support. And so I was trying to encourage people to look at the root cause, because if we don't, we're just going to keep getting the same thing. And of course we did. They gave us Demented Joe. And now
what do you think about Mom Donnie? Because I feel like part of his, well, some people say that he's, you know, a radical and is going to bring about Sharia law. Yeah. The other side is saying that he's a DNC plant. So I'm just curious what your take on Mom Donnie is.
I lean towards the latter on that.
DNC plant?
That's what I think. I think he's central casting.
Yeah, he's going to be another AOC or another Barack Obama. So he's the next flavor of Brooke. That's what I think. And the reason why I say this is because the big thing that stands out for me is that he didn't stand with workers during COVID, right? In fact, still to this day, he doesn't stand up for the people who got fired because of COVID or for not taking a vaccine, an experimental medical treatment.
Exactly.
They couldn't go to work. So he didn't stand up for them then. He's not standing up for them now even. So that's an unbelievably establishment viewpoint at this state of
the day. Do you think that's ideological, or is he bought off by corporations? Like, does he actually feel that the vaccine was good and therefore everybody should take it? Or
I don't know what his thought process is. Well, I just know that what the result is, and the result is he doesn't stand with workers.
Interesting.
It's been such a crazy time since 2020. I was someone who never wanted to take the vaccine, didn't feel comfortable taking the vaccine, and living in California and seeing the way that people behaved against, you know, people like myself that didn't want to take it, I think woke a lot of people up. And it really felt like we were entering in. Ooh, there's a bug on the chair. Ah, where'd it go?
It went down that way.
Oh, we'll just call that Jiminy Cricket for good luck. But, you know, we felt like we were entering into just such a control state, which is what the WEF and the globalists talk about all of the time.
A what state?
Control state.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, even though we now have elected Donald Trump, who was saying, we're going to get, you know, away from the globalists, or, you know, you were bringing up when people elected Barack Obama, it's always kind of been the same story. But it feels like no matter who we elect, we get closer to that globalist agenda no matter what. So do you even think there's a way to break free of that? And how would we do that at this point?
Well, I don't know who coined the phrase, no matter who you vote for, you get John McCain. Right? And
yeah.
So that's what we've been experiencing.
Right.
Even with Trump, right? So Trump comes in as he's the anti-war guy. That's why the deep state wants to kill him. And he ends up, you know, further funding the genocide that's happening in 4K in front of everyone's face. And then he's pals with the head of Al-Qaeda in Syria. That was great for him. And then he bombs Iran. And
we're still funding the Russia-Ukraine thing. Even
and he's still funding that, the Ukraine war. And he bombed Yemen, even though he said that a year earlier, he said, "Yo, you don't have to do that. You could just solve this with a phone call." And no matter who you vote for, you get John McCain. And is there a way out of it? The only way out of it, it seems to me, because the whole scheme for the establishment is to keep people funneled into the two-party system.
Mm-hmm.
And so people need to keep believing that. And the beauty of Trump for the Democratic Party is the Democratic Party can be horrible. They can be criminally horrible to the point where they have a demented guy for 4 years. And then when he on his way out, he departs everybody in his family going back 11 years.
Right. So, preemptive.
So
pardons.
They can be. So you if you can't say anything about that because Trump.
Right.
What? If you want to say anything, well, Trump. Yeah, but you guys, he said he was going to give us the public job. But Trump. He said he was going to give us a minimum wage. But Trump. Yeah, he said he was going to give us health care. And the Trump, you're going to get Trump. So that's the beauty of Trump for the Democratic Party is they can be horrible when they have zero ideas and they can still get elected because Trump. And, you know, Trump right now is doing this thing where he said he's going to evict the homeless from Washington, D.C., which I don't know if he realizes they've already been evicted. That's why they're homeless.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's an interesting one because a lot of people on the right, I think, are saying, yeah, this is good. Why are you arguing against cleaning up the city and crime?
Where are you going to put them?
That's what I said. I'm so like, well, where are they going to go? He said, I'm telling the homeless they better leave D.C. To go where?
To go where? They don't have a home.
Crazy.
So if you're getting, the joke I said on the show was like, why don't you just pretend that they're immigrants and give them hotels? And so, and a lot of those homeless are veterans, as we know. And what was the point of this? I had a point, but bringing up the homelessness. But Trump doesn't really have an idea on how to deal with the homeless problem, right? But guess what? The Democrats never even talk about it. So at least he's talking about it with a bad idea.
Democrats are just going to give money to every single NGO.
They just give. So I live in California. You've done great videos on there's the NGO homeless industrial complex, and it's all graft. It's all corruption. And so instead of the city of Los Angeles, which spends about $1 billion on homelessness, I guess
a year. How crazy is that?
Instead of them hiring someone who works for the city and then hiring city employees to go out and deal with the homeless problem. So now we have accountability. They decide to just give hundreds of millions of dollars to NGOs, non-government organizations that have no oversight and they don't know how the money's being spent. And the next thing you know, Governor Newsom is asked, hey, what happened to that $24 billion you spent on homelessness? And he's like, I don't know. Nobody knows what happened. And so as you've delineated, there's a big scam happening.
It's a deliberate part of the plan. And it's never to really solve it because once you solve it, how are you going to make?
That's correct.
Money?
That there is, and you know, Tucker Carlson had talked about how this isn't by design. They want you, you know, worried on your way to the, you know, have to go past a guy on meth on your way into the 7-Eleven, and then when you get in there, everything's locked up, and then when you come back out, you got another guy on fentanyl, costing you, and so you get so scared that you start to beg for authoritarian solutions.
Mm.
That was what, and I'm like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It just seems crazy that they can just pull, hundreds of billions of dollars out of their ass at the snap of a finger, like when they did with Ukraine. Like, hey, we're going to give just like that, $100 billion.
Yeah.
Like, imagine if they.
And they're also going to stick the TikTok ban in that same bill.
Yeah.
At the same time.
Well, and they did that while Lahaina burnt to the ground.
Right. And they gave them $750
per person. Like,
and you're like, what is going on with our country is, you know, it's beyond repair. I think the only thing that can save it now is some kind of real revolution. I don't know what that would look like, but...
Well, I think they just have to give some things to regular people. They have to, like, at least give the facade that they're serving the people. It's like, oh, no, you guys...
They don't even do that anymore.
Yeah, they don't even do that. It's like, we're still going to trade stocks. They can't even have the basic decency to put on a good show to say, like, yes, we're for the people. Here's a couple of things for you guys, and we're still going to bomb some kids over here. It's like, no, you get nothing. Your roads are broken. Bridges collapsing. But Israel is, you know, going to get all our money, and they have universal health care and everything like that.
Well, it's, you know, it's Israel, it's Ukraine, it's the military industrial complex, you know. I mean, imagine if Trump took that $200 billion that he gave to the Pentagon in this latest budget. You know, they can't pass an audit. Everybody knows that. Everybody wants an audit. They can't pass it. And Trump's solution to that is, well, give them $200 billion more.
Yeah.
What? They don't. You don't even know what they're doing with the $800 billion you're already giving them. Yeah, let's give them another. Let's say we're going to have the first $1 trillion defense budget and act like that was a goal. They go, yeah, he's like, oh, we did it. We got it. We got our first $1 trillion defense, but yay, we did it. And it's like, that's not what anybody wanted. Nobody wanted that.
Nobody
and
voted for that.
People wanted, so imagine if he took that money and gave it to, I mean, I talk about it in my act. Imagine if they took that money and gave it to like $100 billion, give $2 billion to the top 50 cities in America and tell them to go, you know, build drug treatment programs or affordable housing or anything. Parks or, you know, schools or whatever, hire an extra teacher for every class or something. You know what I mean? Like if you go to, I think it's Finland, they have three teachers in each class, right? They have a main teacher and two helpers. And so anyway, I'm just saying there's things we
can. Well, they're socialists and we can't have.
Yeah, yeah. So there's things we could be doing with that money, but they won't. And I'm pretty sure this is how all empires end. We overextend militarily, which is exactly what happened. You know, this is what Eisenhower warned us about the undue influence of the military-industrial complex. Well, we're living in it. This mm-hmm. is it. And our whole, you know, if it's not Big Pharma running the government, it's the military-industrial complex or it's Wall Street or the oil companies. That's it. People like to say to me, you know, oh, you think there's a cabal of people having secret meetings? And I'm like, they're not secret. It's called a session of Congress, and they get together. You think when they get together at a session of Congress, they're doing the bidding of students and workers and the elderly and sick people? And no, they're doing the bidding of the donor class, and that's why the country looks the way it is. We still don't have health care. People still go bankrupt when they get sick. We pay 100% more for our health care than the rest of the world. 80% of the country lives paycheck to paycheck. Half the country can't afford a $500 emergency. So we had bigger income inequality right now than during the Gilded Age. Mm-hmm. So that's the result. And the only thing that you can really, what's going to, people had high hopes for Donald Trump, that he was going to really come in and stop the growth of the deficit. He did the exact opposite. He exploded. You know, all that Doge stuff was a big fake. It was a big psyop kind of. They're like, oh, well, they did. They saved $200 billion. Yeah, they didn't stop spending that money. The whole
right.
the point was to stop spending that money. What they did was they just took that money and folded it into the Pentagon and the State Department. They didn't stop spending that money. They just gave another $200 billion to the Pentagon. So we zero savings.
Yeah, it is interesting. Nick Fuentes, who is a controversial guy, but he's on the rise right now. He's becoming very popular.
Was he that Jewish kid?
The gay kid.
Oh, yeah, no, but
I'm just joking around.
He, you know, was very American first. He was for Trump, but he said something really interesting the other day on his show where he said it would have been better for America if Kamala would have won, because he said nobody would have believed it. People would be out in the streets. If she would have continued to give money to Ukraine, people would be rioting. If she would have continued to give money to Israel with what's going on in Gaza, people would be, you know, in an uproar. If she would have bombed Iran, people would be in the street rioting, and we would have that rise up of the people. This would be something that people would unite on. And, you know, we would maybe get that independent movement to take back our country. Do you agree with that sentiment?
Well, I said something... it's funny that you say that, because I had that thought the other day. Like, I wonder what would have happened had Kamala Harris won. I wonder what would have happened. And this idea that people will finally wake up, I don't think that's happening.
Well, you woke up one day.
Yeah,
you woke up.
It took a while, but it wasn't immediate.
Yeah,
it took a while, right? For the first thing I saw was the corruption inside the Democratic Party because I was a Democrat my whole life,
mm-hmm.
and so I even during Bill Clinton, I was like, this guy deregulating Wall Street, he's exploding the prison population, he's gutting welfare. And I'm like, and I remember I would tell people, like, I don't think Bill Clinton's a friend of the work. Oh, he did NAFTA. I go, Bill Clinton's no friend of the working man. And people are like, what, huh? Well, he was just blessed with great enemies, you know? Mm-hmm. Just like Hillary Clinton and the Democrats were blessed with great enemies. Same thing with Trump. Trump is also blessed with great enemies. You know, their enemies are horrible. They're all horrible. And so the idea that, you know, if Kamala Harris was president, it would wake people up. I don't know.
Yeah,
it would
wake the right up, right? Because the right hates Kamala Harris, so that would make sense. But
even the left didn't like Kamala Harris. I mean, you couldn't watch one of her interviews and think, man, she's qualified for the job.
You like Joe Biden.
I know, true.
I mean, we're not run, but your vote doesn't really matter.
Unless you vote for third party, then it does matter.
But are you ever going to be able to elect that
power.
Person?
Yeah.
You know, it's just kind of a waste of a vote.
That's the establishment talking point there.
Every vote seems wasted at this point, right? Because you never get, no matter who you vote for, you get John McCain.
Right.
And, the Green Party was.
Oh, yeah. We talked to Butch Ware last week, actually.
Oh, really? So did you bring up why they were so gung-ho for their anti-worker? During COVID, just like the rest of the establishment, where they wanted to force people to take experimental medical treatments. They had no skepticism or criticism of the establishment or Big Pharma or criminal Dr. Fauci. They had none. They had zero. And
who
I
also
was like,
got a pardon from Joe
yeah,
Biden
who also got a pardon.
Day.
So, yeah, so that was a big disappointment for me with the Green Party was during COVID that all the people you thought that would stand up and say something didn't. You know,
that's an interesting point. We didn't broach that specific, but you did challenge him a little bit on like weather modification. He didn't really want to, because it was like Green Party, right? Environmentalists, are you down with all this, you know, the chemtrails and all this stuff that's happening?
Well, actually, on that note, you used to live in Pasadena, I read, and you still live in LA. So you lived through these horrific, horrible fires. And now the aftermath of that. You know, it's so interesting because there's such a narrative from the left and a global narrative that climate change is going to, you know, ruin our world. It's the biggest threat. And then you have all these globalists flying around on the private jets. And then you also simultaneously have these weather modification programs to solve the problem. We can make it rain by shooting, you know, silver iodine into the clouds and putting heavy metals into the soil. Do you think that the fires, one, were natural in LA? And then also, what do you think about us manipulating the weather?
I think that it's a fascinating, the story about the fires in LA. One of the most fascinating things is that it became very quickly became a talking point that everybody was saying on TV that, oh, you don't use this to criticize politicians. That you're politicizing this. What? Yeah, that's right. Because it was a political failure. And the fact that there's a fire, and it took 45 minutes for them to ever respond to the first call for the fire. Nobody ever talks about that. The fact that there was a 113-gallon reservoir empty.
Yeah.
At the top of the Pacific Palisades. The fact that the fire chief was complaining that they were trying to shut down firehouses and that all these fire trucks were on repair that weren't fixed, sitting in the yard somewhere. And they didn't have a plan for a fire like this. And yet they went to turn on the fire hydrants and there's no water. And then everybody just repeats that stupid story about, well, you know, when there's a fire that big, they don't have enough water. Yeah, well, that you should think of a plan for that.
Especially when you're right next to the ocean.
Especially there's an ocean right there. Yeah. Especially there's a reservoir with 115 million gallons of water. And I have people go, well, that wouldn't have done anything. And I swear to God, it's just, and then people saying that you shouldn't criticize, who are you to criticize the people running the fire response? Well, I'm a fucking citizen, and those are goddamn politicians who let me down. If not, I'm not going to criticize them, who is supposed to criticize? I'm supposed to wait for Chris Cuomo to get around to it? Who am I supposed to wait to criticize them? Fritz Coleman? Are you shitting me? Of course. that we're supposed to criticize them. We're the electorate. And so it was, again, it was the same type of thing that you saw during COVID. Don't do your own research.
Yes.
Don't question authority. Just go along with what the man on the TV says. And how dare you? You're a right-wing conspiracy theorist. If you want to get informed about COVID, about an experimental medical treatment you're being forced to take. Just like this with the LA fires. Oh, you're some kind of right-wing hater if you want to hold Gavin Newsom and Karen Bass accountable.
You're a white supremacist. If you want to question the fires.
That's right. And so we know that those fires...
Did you see that story that I put out from the local residents saying the one in the Palisades started at the exact same position spot as a fire 7 days before?
Oh, really?
And they didn't properly put it out, but they can't admit that because that would mean they basically are responsible for it. And they pulled up like imaging from satellites and saying, hey, this is a hot spot. And you know how fires, once you kind of sort of put them out, they're still... some smoldering there that could reignite with the right conditions. So there's like Spencer Pratt's talking about a bunch of residents in the Palisades.
I love Spencer Pratt. Have you been watching his coverage?
I haven't.
Oh, he's going off on Newsom right now, every single day.
Well, you know, so Rick Caruso, who ran for mayor and didn't win.
I thought he should have.
And so he has a big mall. He's famous for building these malls, outdoor malls in Los Angeles. He did The Grove, which I lived right next door to it. It was, at the time, a big step forward for outside malls. It was wonderful.
Yeah.
He did the Americana in Glendale, and he has one in the Pacific Palisades, right? So he has this huge mall. And so when the fire started, he sent a private fire department team or a firefighting team to go make sure that his mall didn't burn down. Guess what? His mall didn't burn down. And so when I point that out to people, they go, well, there's nothing they could do. I go, well, Rick Caruso sent a firefighting team to make sure his mall, not one building, a mall.
Yeah.
Not one of the buildings in the whole mall, but burnt down. I go, so this, and they're like, oh, yeah, well, if you're going to do, yeah, so what you're saying is all you need to do is have enough resources and then we could maybe save our city from burning down.
Yeah.
You don't want to devote resources that are necessary to making sure your city doesn't burn down. And a joke I do in my act is, boy, $100 billion, if we spent that we sent to Ukraine, if we spent that in the United States, what could we do with it? I don't know. I live in Los Angeles. I'm just thinking maybe 10,000 fire trucks full of water off the top of my head.
Yeah.
Off the top of my head, 10,000 fire trucks full of water just sitting in a yard waiting because we know we have a thing called fire season in Los Angeles. Well, it's the Santa Ana winds. They act like this was an anomaly that never happened. This happens all the time. And it was just a fluke that it didn't burn the city down before. And so they knew this was coming. In fact, Karen Bass warned everybody the fires are coming because these winds are coming because we know they're coming, the Santa Ana wind. And they did nothing. They didn't refill that reservoir. They didn't have 10,000 fire trucks full of water. They didn't do anything.
Well, do you think part of this is deliberate in that if it does burn down, there are some positive things, quote unquote, positive things that can come out of it, meaning that, oh, well, maybe we get to redesign this part of the city a little bit, maybe put in some housing or do a giveaway to my developer donors. You know, these kinds of things, they're just calculating to say, oh, well, it sucks if it burns down, but now we get some control.
But now we can get the affordable housing that
the
we wanted.
The quote unquote affordable housing. And the stat that I learned last week is that there's actually enough housing in California to house everybody. Like the affordable housing talking point is like, sort of a complete
sham. I mean, there's housing that's empty?
Yeah.
And why is it empty?
Well, because it's more affordable.
Is it for investors?
It's for investors.
Yeah. So I was just talking about this on my show yesterday. And like, if you want to help homelessness, why don't you, or you know, because Cuomo is now trying to do the money.
Andrew or Chris?
Andrew. He's trying to do that new, what does he call it? The Zoran law?
Oh, the Zoran.
And
what is it?
So it's to address the lack of affordable housing in Manhattan, but it's not a good idea.
Okay.
And I was just saying this. I'm like, well, why don't you stop foreign investment into real estate in the United States? Of course, that's never going to happen because the real estate lobby wants that. Because that when if you can get billionaires buying property, it raises the property value for everybody. Everybody makes more money, except the citizens, right? So you just found out that there's enough empty housing.
Yeah, they could have let the $24 billion could have just been spent if they wanted to house people. They just could have housed them, but no. Instead, what they do is they give it to the NGOs or they give it to these real estate developers to develop these luxury condominiums that they say is low income, but there's like three units in there.
Yeah.
And you can't even really get into these units because guess what? One of Gavin's biggest donors during his recall campaign in 2021 was the real estate industry. A bunch of real estate billionaires funded him. And so that's the reason why
vote for, you get John McCain.
I mean, that's
I don't know. I mean, I might like John McCain even better than
Same thing with his plan to make affordable insulin. You know, it's the same scam, right? Mm-hmm. He pretended I'm going to get it to you. Mm-hmm. And so he could veto a bill that capped the price of insulin at $35 because he had this $100 million plan to get you cheap. And then his plan just goes away and he gets to veto that bill and everybody's still paying sky high prices for their insulin. So, I mean, to think that a guy like Gavin Newsom isn't completely bought by corporations and the establishment is you're just silly.
Yeah, he's such a Hunger Games politician, Gavin Newsom.
Yeah.
You know, he looks the part. He's got that smile. Mm-hmm. I don't feel like you could sit down with him and not think, you know, there's a little...
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody could see through the sleazebag, right? Or no?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean,
he's the front runner for the Democrats.
No, I mean, like, there's lots of, my Hollywood friends are like, oh, you can't criticize them over the fire. You can't criticize...
Really?
They're not. Yes.
Even as their house is burning down, you're like, no, we have to temper.
Yes, yes, people, and that. I mean, I talk about it on stage. My next door neighbor. It's like, there's nothing they could do, right? So you can't criticize them. And then all these people saying, "Oh, if you're criticizing them over the fire, you're politicizing it." So you know, there's a lot of different techniques the establishment has to get people to shut up. But it's amazing to me is how much people internalize that. And then they become the warriors for the establishment unwittingly. You know, like during COVID, comedians getting on stage telling people, don't do your own research. Don't question authority. That's what you're saying? Don't question authority. Yes, that is what they're saying.
And I mean, I don't know. I always questioned authority. I was just one of those kids that always questioned everything. And so I want to kind of ask about your upbringing and your life and how you got into comedy and then politics. You and I were just talking a little bit before we started. You grew up in a family of 12,
yeah,
which is crazy. Your dad was also a policeman. Talk about authority. And you were at the youngest at the end. You were 11 of 12, right?
So I was I was the youngest boy. And then, as I told you earlier, my mom went and she wanted a baby. And so we ended up adopting one little sister, and I had one older brother. She got from Catholic Charities as foster children, and then they just stayed with us forever. So, I mean, it was, people would always ask me, what's it like growing up in a big family like that? And I was like, I don't know, because I don't have anything to compare it to. Mm-hmm. I just know what it was like. It was just my life, you know? I didn't know anything else, so it was fine. You know, I went to Catholic school. We drank powdered milk. We were poor. Peanut butter and jellies for lunch and stuff like that. My mom was it wasn't an era of two working people. My mom had to stay home and take care of the 10 kids and then eventually 12. So, what else would you like to know about that?
I mean, nowadays, you know, the youth, when their teacher says, what do you want to be when you grow up?
Mm-hmm.
They say comedian, YouTube star, podcaster. You're both of those things, right? Most kids now want to be a Joe Rogan, a Jimmy Dore, a Theo Vaughn. That wasn't really like a popular career path until recently. So I read that you decided to get into comedy in your late 20s. When you told your family, like, hey, I'm going to go for this, what were you doing before and how did they react to that? Did they think, oh my gosh, you know, is this crazy?
So I had graduated college. I was on the 6-year plan.
What did you study in college?
I got my degree in marketing communications. I was going to go in to be a copywriter for advertising.
Mm.
And
I
had my book. Yeah, it was, you know, a blue collar kid coming from the south side of Chicago. It was like, oh, I could do what Mr. Brady did on the... I think he was an advertising guy. It doesn't matter. No, I think he was an architect.
Yeah, he was. I'm thinking Mad Men.
Yeah. So I was like, I can write for a living. I could be clever for like that. Just because I was doing brick work. My dad had a side job, so he was a cop, and then his second job was he did brick work, and so we all worked with my father, all my brothers, doing the brick work, and everybody I knew were, you know, some kind of a blue collar guy, and so to me it was a big, like, I get to go into advertising. That was a bit, well, I didn't. I graduated college in January, and I was like, well, you know, I'm going to take one more. I don't want to get a job right away. I wanted to go out drinking and chasing women for another. I didn't want to get old. I felt like I didn't want to get old right away and start my life. So I took a summer off. I waited till the fall. I'm going to get a job in the fall. And I didn't even really know how to get a job. But that's when I did my first open mic because, you know, I had seen people on TV that I knew I was funnier than. And I was like, that guy, I'm funnier than that guy, and he's on TV.
Yeah.
If he's on TV, I'm sure I could do it in a club, right? And so I went to my first open mic in, like, I don't know, August of 1989. And then I never looked back, really.
So you got jokes. You killed it on your first...
My first time went really well, and then I didn't get a laugh for about a month.
Okay.
which is common for a lot of comedians who end up doing it for a living, is their first time goes well, and then they eat it for a while. And that's certainly what happened to
me. And Chicago was kind of like a comedy mecca at the time, right?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. It was definitely, there was a comedy explosion. I remember one time I counted, there were 14 full-time, meaning at least Tuesday through Sunday, comedy clubs either in Chicago or within an hour's drive from downtown Chicago.
Wow.
So that's a lot of clubs.
And did you pass or have interactions with any of your role models in the space when you were coming up?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the weird thing about, you know, I remember the first time I worked with Jake Johansson. I don't know if you know who he is, but I was seeing him on TV, you know, when I was in high school and college, and I was like, oh, this guy's hilarious.
But I'm funnier.
And then I got to work with them, and it was always weird. A lot of that happened. I would work with people that I'd seen on TV, Rich, Jenny. I remember the first time I worked with Norm Macdonald. It was before he was famous, and he was hilarious. So it was a real heady experience, and I really loved it.
What was your material when you first started? Was it political to start with, or was it?
No, it was just whatever, you know, comedy's a lot harder than it looks. And
I think it's hard because I just saw a comedy show last week and I'm like, there's no way I could do this because you're going up there and you're expected to be funny. You have to read the crowd properly. You have to go sometimes off the cuff, do a little crowd work. I think it's incredibly challenging.
So, yeah, I mean, I had jokes. I was not good for a while. There's a big learning curve to doing stand-up comedy. But, you know, I could get by. But the good thing about starting in Chicago was there were so many clubs, I could get work right away. So I could get on stage and do 15 minutes a night paid. And then I could do 30 minutes a night paid. And eventually before I left, I was doing 45 minutes a night, but I could do it every night somewhere. Mm-hmm. And so the only thing that makes you get better as a stand-up is stage time. And so that's the thing that's really hard to get in Los Angeles. So I don't know how people start. So when I moved to Los Angeles in 1995, I was already making a living as a comedian, and I was doing colleges even. I had a college agent, and that paid big money at the time. You go out and do one show. I remember you do one show for like $1,500, right? So I'm like, I could pay. That's my, you know, I could pay my rent and my everything. Oh, that's my monthly expenses right there, one gig. So I would go out and do like one or two of these colleges, and then come back to L.A., and stay for the month, you know, and try to get on stage and make my, and it was fun. It was, you know, it could be discouraging, but anything worthwhile is going to be hard. It was hard, but it really paid off. But, you know, I remember when I decided I was moving to Los Angeles, you know, of course, a lot of people shit on you right away and try to make you.
Because you're a sellout.
You know, try to like, oh, what are you going to, oh, it's over. You know, everybody I know goes, it's over. And there's nothing there and stuff like that. I'm like, there's nothing there.
Dude, the traffic.
I went then I started getting on TV right away. You know, I got on Comedy Central. I got on A&E.
So you're in Los Angeles and your parents are and your family still in Chicago. And are they tuning in like, oh, my God, Jimmy's going to be on TV?
I don't know what they were doing, but they weren't, you know, my parents were not big boosters of my comedy career.
Okay.
And they thought I was wasting my college education and I should go get a job. And, you know.
So did they get to watch you become such a big success?
Yeah.
They did?
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
And then, you know, and then my parents were, they retired. to Bullhead City, Arizona, which is right by Las Vegas. So they would be in Los Angeles a lot because my sister lived here with her family. So they would be here a lot. And I remember I was doing a show for NBC. I think it was called Friday Night Videos. So I did a bunch of those. And I was backstage. And Jay Leno was back there because he would go out. It was during the Olympics. He would go out and do his monologue. And then so then we used his stage to do this show called Friday Night Videos. And my parents were backstage. And I think that was the first time my mom finally was like, oh, wow, this is
he's kind of a big deal.
He's kind of, yeah, he's not an idiot. And yeah. Jay Leno's back here. Or it's NBC. He's a people are, you know, people are talking to him with respect, you know?
Yeah. Like, oh.
So I think that kind of, I think my mom kind of, well, she used to send me articles all the time about you should go do real estate. She wanted me to get into real estate.
Oh,
she's like,
funny.
Look at these people. You'd be great at it.
You could have been the president of the United States.
I could have been president of the United States. And she's like, you should do this for a living. You'd be great. And she always wanted me to do something. I'm like, Mom, I'm doing comedy. And I remember when I got my first half hour special on Comedy Central. So this is kind of how my parents thought. So I get my half hour on Comedy Central, tapes on Broadway in New York, goes amazingly well. I'm still, they just finally put that up on YouTube. The Comedy Central used to not put their comedy stuff on YouTube. They wanted you to go to their website. Yeah. So now they finally figured it out and they started putting stuff up on YouTube. So my first half hour special is now up on.
Oh, cool. We'll have to check that
on
out.
On YouTube. And and so my mom, of course, they didn't come to the taping. Why would you come to the tape? And I would. If my kid was taping a half hour special on Broadway, I would go. And so they didn't. And so afterwards, after it aired, my mom said, well, I hope somebody sees this in Hollywood. I hope somebody sees this and does something for you. And I said, Mom, somebody did see me. And they did do something for me. What did they do for you? I go, they gave me a half hour comedy special on television. They did something, but that's it. It's like, oh, hopefully this gets you something. Like it was funny because that's how everybody in Hollywood thinks. But that was also how my parents thought. Like, oh, maybe this will get you.
Well, I think it's different for the eras. I don't know. Nowadays, it's like nobody understands. Like my parents don't understand the podcasting. Like, what is a podcast? Like,
Even worse, you're a TikToker.
Or a TikToker, these kinds of new things that everybody wants. I mean, it's not ideal to have like a podcast-based economy, like Tim Dillon said, but here we are.
Well, I think it is. I think it's great that the whole point of why I had to move to Los Angeles was because there's gatekeepers in show business.
Oh, no, I agree with the non-gatekeeping.
And I did very well. I had two Comedy Central specials. The second one was called Citizen Jimmy, and it was actually won award. It was chosen Best of the Year by iTunes,
wow,
and Punchline Magazine. And the reason I tell you that is because if I don't, fucking nobody will. And so I thought when that happened, I was with this really good manager, Jim Gaffigan's manager, actually, Alex Murray, who's a great manager, brilliant guy. And I was like, well, here we go. I'm going to become the next Jim Gaffigan. He had a special. It happened. I have a special.
Yeah.
And then it didn't happen. And I didn't. It didn't really result. I would only sell handfuls of tickets wherever I went. I thought I was going to start selling. It didn't work.
And when was this?
That was 2008.
So just a few years before you started your YouTube.
Yeah. So I had started. Yeah. So I had started doing a radio show for KPFK. They saw me do. I started doing a live version of the show I do now in my studio. I still do it. I still do live. I was called Rumble Time for a while. And so it's just my show with a panel in front of a live audience, and I make it funny. And so it's like, I tell people it's like Bill Maher, but funny. And so I had started doing that at the UCB Theater here in Los Angeles, which was a big deal.
Yeah.
And so some people from KPFK Radio happened to see me, and they gave me a radio show. They're like, hey, you want to do a radio? I'm like, sure, I'd love to do a radio. So I did I had a radio show on KPFK for probably, I don't know, 12 years. And that didn't crack it, right? I had a podcast that was popular that would get around 50,000 downloads per per episode, still didn't crack it. I got hooked up with the Young Turks. I started guest hosting for them, and still that didn't move the needle. And it wasn't.
Well, that's where I found you. So it moved some needle.
It moved some, yeah. But it wasn't until I started my. It was kind of a blessing that Cenk Uygur kept trying to keep me behind a paywall, right? I think
you disagreed with that at the time.
Of course.
Did he feel like you were so good, we got to keep Jimmy behind the paywall so everybody's going to subscribe, or did he want to silence you? That's the other theory.
I don't think he wanted to silence me. I just think he was afraid of somebody outshining him.
Oh. Mm.
And so that's why they kept me behind the paywall. And I'm very actually, for all the garbage that they've said about me, I'm still very grateful to Cenk Uygur. I learned a lot from him. From learning how to broadcast and how to do this. And, he's a colorful character. And I didn't know you could be angry. And I remember one day I'm like, oh, I've been trying to keep that under wrap. Like, you can just be angry and that's okay. And so once I was like, hold my beer. here I go. And so... And then he gave me a show called The Aggressive Progressive, put me behind a paywall, which kind of, and then I was like, okay, they're not going to give me a show, right? That's all I wanted was my own show. And that was, everybody could see. So I was like, well, I guess I got to do it myself. So I started to build my own studio in my garage in Pasadena. And I remember Cenk calls me in for a meeting. He goes, now I hear you're building your own studio. What's this about? And I said, well, I want to be you, Cenk. Are you the only one who gets to be you? What do you think?
Yeah.
And I don't think he expected that kind of honesty. Mm. Like, I think he wanted me to say, oh, nothing. I'm just, going to do some side stuff. Or like, I go, I want to be you. I want to do what you're doing. And he didn't know what to say back to that. And he's like, okay. And that was that. And then as soon as I started doing that show, immediately. So
really?
All the TV I had done, all the TV specials I had done, I even had a Hulu special. So I had two Comedy Central specials. I had a Hulu special called Sentence to Live. I had a book that got published, and I was on Comedy Central and NBC and CBS and ABC. I was on all the stuff, and it didn't move the needle. As far as selling tickets and being me, all I ever wanted to be was George Carlin, right? I wanted to be, he was always my idol. And I was like, if I could talk about stuff that I care about and I get to, people want to pay to see it, that's a dream. That's the dream.
When you were working with the big stations and the big networks, did they ever come to you in terms of your material and say, hey, you can't say this or
yeah,
that?
Of course.
Okay. So that's
probably the issue. Yeah, of course. You have to submit your set to them before you do. And they have to approve it.
Well, that's the issue, because the audience doesn't find that to be authentic, because you're not actually saying what you have on your mind.
Yeah, I mean, that's the problem with the television. That's why, late night TV doesn't, it used to be a big deal to do late night TV, and then it's not anymore. It doesn't mean anything.
No, I only see late night TV when the segment is not going well, and we see it as a viral clip.
It died with Stephen Colbert and the vaccine with all the dancing syringes.
The vaccine. Yeah, that's...
So there's this... I know, there's this guy who did a... His name is Ipso. He's foreigner. I don't know exactly where he's from, but somewhere in Europe. And so he has a heavy accent, and he did a set... And I used to see him at the Comedy Magic Club down in Hermosa, and I thought he was really funny, right? He had all these funny jokes. And he did a Conan spot, I guess. And then he put the Conan spot up on Facebook. And then on Facebook, it caught on. It got viral on Facebook. And I'm like, well, that's not because of Conan. That's because of Facebook.
Yeah.
Right.
So he could have done that same set anywhere, put it up on Facebook. And the power is gone.
What we're trying to do right now.
Was that a moment where you thought, I need to get on YouTube? Or... Were you already on YouTube?
No, the moment was when I was like, when I realized. So they started doing this thing at the Young Turks where you'd walk into the newsroom and it was gigantic. And they had all these satellite shows and they would list how much money they made, like they would each month. I don't know why they thought that was a good idea.
How much each show made?
Yeah, but I remember
you're like, I'm not getting enough.
I was a competition. It's like, I want to be the top rated show on the Young Turks network kind of thing.
Yeah, and I think that was what they were thinking that would help. But all it did was made me realize I got to do my own goddamn show, because all these guys with no talent are making. I remember I looked and this guy with almost zero talent was making $10,000 a month off his YouTube show and in his from his mom's basement, and I was like, I could fucking do that. Are you kidding me? That's when I was like, I gotta do this. I have to do this.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because you said that that's why you got into comedy in the first place too, right? Is you saw somebody on TV and you're like, I'm funnier. Yeah. I can do it.
So it's ironic that good comedy made me love comedy, and it was bad comedy that gave me the courage to try it. Mm. And the same thing with YouTube. It was these bad YouTubers. I'm like, this fucking guy. I'll crush it. I'll crush it. And to be fair, one of the same guys that I'm talking about was always encouraging me to do my own show. He's like, Jimmy, you would kill it. Do your own show. Yeah. And I didn't realize how much money that guy was making. And then when they put it up on the wall, I was like, are you fucking kidding me? So that's when my wife and I decided to empty out our garage and hire a construction crew, and let's build a studio. So we did.
And so how quick did it?
Immediate. It was like within 6 months of my show, I started. So I remember I booked myself in, we did a GoFundMe, and the GoFundMe was to help build the studio and really to pay my editor. So I didn't have money to pay my editor. I would pay him $20 an hour. He's really worth, at the time, $40. So I can pay you half out of my pocket, and then we'll do a GoFundMe and I'll pay you the rest. So we do this GoFundMe and we raise enough money to pay for his salary, right? Which is really what I wanted. And and the guy who ran the GoFundMe told me, he goes, yeah, you got a big following in Portland. Like in Portland, Oregon. He goes, a lot of people, he goes, you should go do a stand-up gig there. And I'm like, yeah, okay. All right, let's see what happens. So I contacted a theater there and sold out. And I was like, what? So we added another show, sold out. So I sold 800 tickets. And I was like, are you kidding me? This is what I've been waiting for my whole goddamn life. I thought it was over. You know, I thought after my third comedy special on Hulu, I was like, all right, I did three specials. I did all the ABC, NBC, CBS. I did Comedy Central. I had a book. I played the improvs. I toured headliner around the world. I've been invited to, I did it. I was like in my 50s. I'm like, I was like 50, I think. I was like, all right, I did it. I'm done. All right. I can die. I never started selling tickets, but I'm like, all right, but most people, 99% of comedians don't start selling, over starts. So I'm like, all right, but I did it. I accomplished it. I'm not a failure. It made me, I feel like, oh, thank God I'm not, because I'm worried I'm going to be a failure. That's the whole thing. You don't want to be a failure. And
but was the material like different markedly, right? From when you were doing it independently versus doing it with the big specials. Like you said, you couldn't really speak. Your set was sort of censored in a way that it wasn't later on. And I think that probably made a lot of difference with the audience.
I mean, the half hour, I mean, I knew how to, I wasn't that censored. I was more censored like if I did ABC, CBS, they were much more meticulous. Comedy Central pretty much let you say what you want. And then they might just cut something out after. But they didn't cut anything out of my specials. So I knew how to do it.
There's so many people today in their 20s, their 30s, their 40s, and they just feel like a failure because they haven't accomplished anything yet or what they think they should, mm-hmm. right? And so you're somebody who already kind of won by 50 in a lot of ways. You had these books and these comedy shows, but you really hit it big. You kept trying new things. What would be your message to all those people that are like, I'm 35 and, I haven't done it yet? I mean, just to keep trying and try new things or?
Of course. Yeah. I mean, do what you want to do, find out what your passion is and do it. And what's funny is like I could be, I learned through doing the Young Turks for 10 years, like how to talk on camera, how to talk to a camera, how to be myself. And a lot of times I would get called in to host certain things with a comedic bent and I would get close to it. Like I hosted a couple of pilots, but they didn't go. So when I got, and I'm like, all right, I'm done. I don't need someone to decide whether I get to do my show. And so now I'm just going to do my show and I'm just going to be myself and we'll see what happens. And it turns out people connected with me and I started selling tickets right away, which was always my dream.
Yeah. I mean, I think just to take that on a broader scale, right? I think that's like part of the malaise in America is like people have these instructions like, hey, if you do A, B, and C, you're going to have a nice life. You're going to have a house, a family. But then that seems to be totally gone now.
And that's why I think young people sort of hate America. I mean, I don't hate America. I think America has been really good for me, but I can understand why there's so much angst and revolutionary kind of feeling with the young people. So does that, like, is there something about this country that's like missing? Is the formula need to be rewritten or a little bit like that? What do you think?
I don't really understand what you're asking me.
Like, what I'm asking is, is it about agency in like, hey, you just need to work harder and pursue your dreams and you can still have the American dream? Or is there something fundamentally broken with the system?
Oh, definitely there's something
where like people, even if they work their hardest, they can't make it.
Well, the people who, the people who are working the hardest aren't sitting in a boardroom on Wall Street. You know what I mean? The people who work the hardest are the guys picking fruit, or the guys at the working at the In-N-Out. You know, those guys are working, and guys working at a fulfillment center at an Amazon. Those people are working hard, right? But you know, as Tucker Carlson said at that Turning Points thing, he said, you know, my measure of an economy is if my two kids who are in their late 20s working full-time jobs, can they afford a house? And they can't. So I don't care what your GDP says. This is what I'm caring about. And so, no, I think that the, you know, Steve Bannon also talked about the way they bailed out the banks in 2008 made it so this next generation would not be able to afford a house. Now, I don't know that stuff about how that kind of financial shit works, but he explained it one time and I kind of understood it, how they kind of knew that they were doing this and that we were going to end up in this situation. And here we are in this situation. And so, no, it's sure, you could still get ahead. There's no doubt you can get ahead in America working hard. But the idea that just working hard will get you ahead is not true, because I know a lot of people who work two and three jobs and they didn't get ahead. And so, again, I think we need a fundamental, you know, the income disparity is bigger than it was during the Golden Age. It's just the way, you got to go back to the time of the pharaohs to find out a greater income disparity. And I don't know when the people are going to rise up. I don't know if it will ever happen, because they're so bombarded with propaganda and they're so easily divided. And so people have spent at least the last 10 years hating half the country, hating the other half of the country, and that half hating the other half, which is exactly what the establishment wants.
But I think there's hope because of voices like yours, right? You have 1.6 million subscribers on YouTube. That's massive, right? CNN's not getting those views. Fox isn't getting those views. You are, and you're someone who is independent. You're not bought and paid for. And you've also been courageous enough, from what I've researched and understand, to switch sides on certain topics. And I think people overall in America resonate with that, because at the end of the day, politics has become like a team sport where I'm blue, I'm red, but really everybody just wants the same things. We want peace, clean water, clean food, clean air.
Good schools,
good
roads.
Affordable
health care.
Right. And so it's like so refreshing to have voices like yours out there. And I guess my hope is that we just don't enter more censorship where the establishment, you know, because that's the biggest threat, right? Like you said, they always want to create division in these different elections. And so I think
it's amazing to me, because I always consider myself a lefty, and it's amazing to me how they got people who also consider themselves lefties to become right-wing fascists. Like they all of a sudden I don't even like to call it right-wing, because the right-wing people I knew were not for censorship. They weren't for forced experimental medical treatments.
Right.
They weren't for war. Right. So I think that's even a misnomer, but they became fascists. These leftists, people who consider themselves lefties, all of a sudden were like, yeah, you know, censorship is good. Freedom of speech doesn't mean freedom of reach and stuff like that, you know, and therefore the Ukraine war.
Depends on the topic, that if it fits there, if they agree with a certain topic, then it's like, okay, free speech. But if we don't agree with that, it's very dangerous.
That's hate speech. So we have to censor it. We have to censor it to protect.
Right.
It.
How did Ben Shapiro go from like facts, not feelings, to like, oh, well, every Jew.
So it's all feelings.
Safe space on
Jews
campus.
Need safe spaces. Yeah. He went from, you know, it's good to be, you go to college, so you become uncomfortable and you're forced with ideas that make you uncomfortable. He went from saying that to Jews need a safe space. And
because God, there are too many bake sales for the Gazans.
How did he do that? He's a tribal thinker and he's not consistent. And so he was never committed to free speech. Yeah. So that just, he's revealed as a fraud. So Ben Shapiro is a fraud.
So who are some of the people out there that are doing, that are crushing it right now that you really like?
That's, you.
Oh, well, aww. Thank you. Well, that means a lot to me.
I think
appreciate
you're doing
that.
A great job. I'm a big fan of the guys at the Gray Zone, Aaron Mate and Max Blumenthal and Anya Parampel and others. I also like Due Dissidence. I don't know if you're aware of that show.
Yep.
So there's only a couple of shows I watch. Those are the three. So it's Glenn Greenwald, Due Dissidence, and Gray Zone. Those are the only. And you, I see you.
Appreciate that.
But you don't have a. This is you didn't have a show. You just had clips that I would catch on Twitter, and those are the three that I really watch. Ian Carroll, I think, has done a lot of great work, and so. He shot up really fast, so he's going to get a lot of hate coming at him.
Well, everybody thinks he's a Fed. And I met him really, really early when he was...
Oh, he's a Fed.
Oh, yeah, everybody's a Fed now. Have you been following Tucker Carlson and Nick Fuentes?
Everybody's a Fed.
I mean, Tucker Carlson might...
He might actually be one.
I
but I think everybody who has influence is sort of, whether you like it or not, either knowingly or unknowingly parroting some kind of Fed propaganda.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I don't feel like I'm.
Yeah,
I'm not accusing you, Jimmy, of anything.
I don't know
involved.
What kind of. I don't know what kind of Fed propaganda. I mean, there was a.
Well, what I'm saying is, like, for example, like Tim Dillon, him having dinner with J.D. Vance and saying, "Hey, this is what J.D. told me during dinner." That's sort of whether or not he's getting paid to say that, he is now parroting state propaganda. So being close,
influenced by,
he's being influenced. Like, this is one of the questions, like with the Rogan Sphere comedians, right? They're now going from anti-establishment to now being a part of the establishment. And so then what do you do in that situation?
Well,
as a comedian,
I think that, for instance, a guy like Joe Rogan, well, I've never known him to be anything except sincere and honest, right? So when, no matter what you think, and he's took big chances, and the establishment came at him hard when he told the truth about COVID or even the trans issue, right? He spoke his truth about it, which turned out to be correct, that you shouldn't have biological males in combat sports against females without telling them that you're... Anyway, so...
no, that's a big deal.
So... And what I've not, I mean, I'm not an avid viewer of Joe's show. I watch it. I see it mostly in clips, you know. What I have seen him is push back on Trump and saying, this is nobody voted for this. This is not what we wanted. We wanted you to go after drug cartels and criminals. And now you're going after people for thought crimes. And so he's not on board. I think that he's true to himself. I think that he had, like a lot of people, had hope that Donald Trump would be what he was claiming to be. And I thought that there was a big chance at that happening because it seemed like the deep state really didn't want him to become president, like the two assassination attempts. But then when he gets in office and he immediately like, we're done looking into that Pennsylvania assassination attempt, that Butler.
Epstein, who cares about that?
Who cares about Epstein?
he didn't exist.
The assassination into yourself?
Yeah.
You don't give a shit about? No. So that's when I'm like, he's just, and Kurt Metzger on my show says that, you know, Trump just represents a different faction of the deep state. So the deep state has different factions and they fight against each other, and Trump just he's bombing Iran, he's funding a genocide, suppressing the Epstein files, he's not even looking into his own assassination attempt, and he's still funding the Ukraine war. Plus, he's doing he added $200 billion to the Pentagon budget, which is mostly to set up a new surveillance state, right? That's what the Golden Dome really is. And that's a giveaway to Palantir. So he's ushering in a surveillance state on steroids. So he's nothing that anybody was hoping that he would be. And the people who are still clinging and still, you know, I'm still a Trumper, they're just lying to themselves and they don't want to see what's actually happening. He exploded the deficit. He exploded the Pentagon budget. All those DOGE savings are zero. They all went away. He created new protected class for hate speech. He's throwing people in jail, kicking them out for thought crimes. This is not what anybody thought he would do.
And is that something that happens once you get into power and you're like, oh shit, I can't do any of this stuff? Or is it kind of disingenuous from the first place?
He was an establishment creature.
But what about people like Tulsi Gabbard? You know, like people that I liked back
RFK
in the days,
Jr.
They're now acting in a completely different. Bongino, Cash Patel, they're like railing on the establishment. They get in there and says, well, he killed himself. What the hell happened here?
Nothing to see here. I mean, Dan Bongino saying, don't let this story go away, folks, on his own show. Don't keep an eye on this story. Don't. And then it's like, it's all.
Do you think they get in there and it's like the mob and they say, welcome. We will kill you and your family and everybody that you know if you don't get in line. I mean, because it feels like some of these guys, like Dan, for example, wants to release the Epstein files or do right on behalf of his viewers and supporters. But now it's like he can't. His hands are tied. What's happening?
Bill Hicks was one of my favorite comedians, if not my favorite of all time. He had a bit about when a new president gets elected. They take him into a room.
Okay.
And they show him a video of the JFK assassination.
God.
From an angle you've never seen before. And they turn it off and they go, any questions? Nope, I got it. And it seems like that's what happened with Trump. I mean, him and Judge Napolitano. Napolitano tells a story about hey, why don't you release the JFK files? And Trump tells Napolitano, well, if you saw what I saw, you wouldn't. Well, what the fuck did he see? Why can't you, Judge, did you not ask him that question? What did you see? And why? What was it? And so, I think I don't know what happens to those people, but of course there's this unbelievable pressure and the deep state is real and they're not going to.
Well, did you hear about Bongino recently? Because apparently he wants to go back to podcasting because it's probably more fun.
and he's not going to ruin his reputation.
Right. So he's now leaking. There's stories coming out that he's a leaker, and JD and Trump and Cash were meeting to see, like, what do we do about Bongino? Did you hear about this?
No. But I would be fearful for my life in that situation because it seems like, you know, they say people get Clintoned, right? It seems like if you get in the establishment and then you try to get out, it usually doesn't end well. You end up falling off of a balcony on the 24th floor taking a selfie all of a sudden. So that would be scary.
Or that who was the – I just had a congressman on my show.
Democrat or Republican?
I think he might have been a Republican, but he was an ex-fireman and he was questioning the 9/11 back in like 2003 or 4. He was set to become, I just had him on my show. And Tucker had him on after that. And he was set to become like the chair of the Armed Services Committee or some kind of committee. And the FBI went and planted shit on him and his daughter, got him. And so, and they threw his election. So they got rid of him.
He's not in Congress anymore.
No.
Uh-huh. I think I saw that on Tucker, possibly.
Why am I blanking on
LJ,
this guy's name?
Look that up real quick.
Why am I blanking on this guy's name? We got like a million views on that video. It was one of our most popular videos. And anyway, so that's how they do it. Like they have as Chuck Schumer said after Donald Trump was elected over Hillary Clinton, he was on with Rachel Maddow and it was at a time when Trump didn't really know how the game worked and he was being critical of the CIA and the FBI. And Chuck Schumer says to Rachel Maddow, you know, for a smart guy, he's being really dumb to go after the intelligence community. And Rachel Maddow says, why? He says, because if you go after the intelligence community, and I hear they're not happy with him at all. So they have six ways to Sunday to get back at you. And we're like, so what he just revealed in that moment was that's all called a gaffe because he actually told the truth. Mm-hmm. And the truth is that the CIA and the FBI and the NSA doesn't work for the president. Because if they did, why would the president have to be afraid of them? The president is worried about them, what they're going to do to him. So that tells me that they don't work for the president. The question that Rachel Maddow should have asked was, well, then who do they work for? Of course, she didn't ask that question because she works for the same establishment.
Well, she's part of the Mockingbird.
Yeah, she is 100%. You don't think she knew that Russiagate was a complete invention by the Clinton campaign? If I knew it, I was able to bust that Russiagate in 2016 that was all bullshit. I brought Bill Binney on my show. It would all hinged on the DNC server being hacked by Russia. I proved forensically that couldn't happen. So it was most likely a local download to a thumb drive that was given to Seth Rich. And that's why they killed Seth Rich.
Mm. So,
and then they made it toxic to ask. You can't. So whatever you can't ask questions about. So that's the one thing I noticed doing my show is that whenever you're not allowed to ask questions about something, there is some real fuckery happening, right? So like you were never allowed to question 9/11. And now we come to find out Building 7 was completely imploded, right?
It's weird.
And people don't even know about what Building 7 was. They don't even know. What's that?
I saw a clip the other day of Rosie O'Donnell on The View after 9/11. And she is questioning now, kind of saying what a lot of people are saying now. What happened?
Yeah,
Have you seen that clip?
I've seen that clip. That's
and
right.
And it made me think so differently of Rosie O'Donnell because I'm like, damn, has she been pushed out to Scotland or wherever she's living now because she opened her mouth and was speaking the truth back then about 9/11? It just makes you wonder. And then recently, like a few days ago, she posted something where she said, like, blackout the establishment. Did you see that? And I'm like, what is she trying to tell us? Because now I'm like, she was telling the truth about 9/11. But
so it started with 9/11. They made you a crazy kook. Even if you were an engineer and you had questions about illegit, just like they did with COVID. So they did it with 9/11. You were a truther. They took the word truth and they turned it into a toxic word. It's amazing how they did that. You're a truther. You mean I'm seeking truth? Yeah, you're a truther. So then they did it with that. They did it with Syria gas attacks. They did it with Russia, the Russiagate. You were a crazy conspiracy theorist. They did it with Seth Rich. You couldn't ask normal questions about Seth Rich. I got put in a Washington Post article they put me in with Nazis, pedophiles, white supremacists, and me. And it was all about how people are, are getting radicalized on YouTube, right? And Jimmy Dore with the Seth Rich. And I'm like, I was just asking normal questions. So I remember I was on a panel with the Young Turks and Ben Mankiewicz from Turner Classic Movies and Cenk Uygur was on the panel with me. And this was after I'd been smeared in the Washington Post for asking. And they didn't have my back and they wouldn't ask those. They were not curious because they knew where the pressure was coming. You can't ask these questions or else you'll be discredited. And I remember sitting there and I said to both of them, I said, when was the last time a reporter wasn't allowed to ask questions about an unsolved murder in Washington, D.C.? Can you imagine another time? They're like, no. I go, why is this the only time a reporter is not allowed to ask questions about it's an unsolved murder. They don't know who did it. And I'm not allowed to ask questions about it. Well, that's because they knew who did it. They knew exactly what. And then it turns out 5 years later, we find out that the FBI is not going to release the Seth Rich's laptop. Oh, why? First, they said they didn't have it. They were lying. Then they said they couldn't access that stuff. They were lying. So then they said, we got it, but we can't release it because of that. So then a judge twice ordered the FBI to release the contents of Seth Rich, and they still haven't done it. They go, we're going to release it in 65 years, which sounds very...
That's the same with the COVID.
They do it with everything,
they
right?
They do it with JFK. They do it with, sure. Here we are. So whenever you're not allowed to ask, same thing with COVID. You weren't allowed to ask questions about COVID. You weren't allowed to ask questions about the vaccine or masks or lockdowns or where the virus came from, or you were a white supremacist. So whenever you're not allowed to ask questions, that's when I realize, oh, there's something there.
For sure.
So that's the one thing I know for sure is that when they make it toxic to ask a question about something, there's something there.
100%. And for me, if I get a story taken off of TikTok, then I'm like, oh, I'm speaking the truth.
Oh, yeah.
Chemtrails, mRNA vaccines in our cows. Yes. I'm like, oh, my God, they're killing us, you know?
For me, it's obviously Israel, because I do speak a lot about that. And I had a call. I posted last week because there was a new head of TikTok moderation that was hired, and she just so happened to be, like, an American who went to Israel, served in the IDF, made Aliyah. And I just pointed that out. And then I get a call from a good friend of mine who knows some very high-up people at TikTok. She says, you need to probably take that down because they're going through and they're banning accounts.
They banned me. I got banned three times from TikTok.
You got it back? Or?
Well, yeah, I got banned like 3 or 4 weeks ago because I think I insinuated that our FBI director is being honeypotted. They didn't like that. So
Yeah. So no, TikTok is the worst, and Instagram. But yeah, I got kicked off of TikTok twice. So we just have to start a new account and start from zero.
Yeah. Well, what's crazy?
Well, I might be able to help you.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What's crazy is there's this content creator on TikTok that does the news, also Instagram. His name's Dylan Page, and he lives in the UK, and he's huge, 10, 12, 13 million subscribers. No, and he did a story the other day. This was just last week. And TikTok allowed it, even though they have super strict policies. But the UK did a local ban on the video.
Because of the new UK law, you know about that.
And so he said, if the UK now... local laws are worse than the notoriously bad censorship on TikTok. I have to get out of here. But you just are starting to see this almost like test zones, right? Pop up around the world where I feel like these democracies are testing a population. Let's see how much we can control them before we roll it out. Do you feel like that?
Well, COVID was certainly a test.
For sure.
To see how much people would take and how much they could control them. And now they're floating the ideas of having climate change lockdowns. Have you heard about this?
Yes.
Have you seen what's going on in Canada right now?
What, by people walking in the forest? Getting
a $25,000 fine?
Yeah, fishing or whatever.
I was joking on our episode on Tuesday. I'm like, imagine if you're a grandpa and you're out fishing with your son. And, you know, you're like, come on, son. And you cast your line. And then, you know, here, down on your knees, you know, and you get arrested and thrown in the river. Like, what world are we living in where you can't fish or walk in the woods?
But you can fly your private jet over the woods.
Well, yep.
Yeah, and
because they're doing good stuff, they're monitoring the situation. Bill Gates says, "Wait, he's my contributions to society are worth my emissions."
I've heard a stat that one private jet flight burns more carbon than my car does in my lifetime. I don't know if that's true.
Yeah, it is.
I'm pretty sure that's true. And so, yeah, but guys like Bill Gates say, "Well, I buy carbon offsets."
And where they're just tokenizing force. They just made it into a whole game here.
So isn't that like Jeffrey Epstein saying, I buy rape offsets?
I help sponsor a woman's pregnancy and motherhood so I can rape a few other
kids. Right. So, I mean, it was like Harvey Weinstein donating to, you know, women's sports or something.
That's funny.
Although Candace is saying he's innocent. I'm just going to throw that out.
Yeah,
there.
I know. Yeah.
I don't know that I believe her on that, but I do believe Bridget Macron was born a man. If you've seen that.
Well, it would be so easy for Bridget Macron to prove that.
Right.
So, like, and it'd be one thing if she didn't care about the story.
Right.
Right.
But she obviously does care enough to ask President Trump to intervene.
Yes. And now they're suing her.
And now they're suing her. So if you care so much, why wouldn't you just show up with your brother somewhere? Why wouldn't you just, anyway, it's just.
I mean.
Because if I say Jimmy's a woman, you're not going to give a shit because you're like, I'm obviously not.
I'll take it.
You just say nothing.
Well, also, it's like,
what does it matter?
Yeah, what does it matter? You're in power.
She was, you know, like the Brooke Shields teacher, right? And that, you know, Macron just fell for her. And then you go back and they show these photos and she's like, you know, a man with a wig wearing a scarf around her Adam's apple. And you go, that's not Brooke Shields, you know? So anyways, everything Candace brings up about that, I'm like.
It's pretty obvious that they're covering.
And then did you see Bridget smack him around on
the plane?
Of course,
yeah. But people don't know.
I've heard around the world.
People don't know what. You only saw that part of the video. People don't know what led up to that. Right before that, Macron had hit Brigitte right in the balls.
Exactly.
And, you know, and she's on edge. She's going through menopause. And. And, you know, he tried to dismiss it, just a couple of bros goofing around. And,
exactly. Oh, my God, it's hilarious.
So we have a couple minutes left, I think. But let's try to end this on the message of hope here. Like, let's take us back to 2015, 2016.
There was a lot of hope then.
There was a whisper of hope. I remember you guys said every single primary day I was there tuning in, a whisper of hope. So
I thought for sure.
Is Jimmy Dore running for president?
That's
is that what's going on
ask.
Here?
Are you
going
to save us?
Is this...
It's not you.
Big announcement from Jimmy Dore today.
No, that's not happening. What needs to happen is a real. Electoral politics isn't going to get us out of this. We can't. I don't think we're going to be able to vote our way out of this. So I remember that there was a lot of hope back then because Bernie Sanders had woken up half the party of the Democratic Party, and a lot of people on the right too had woken up and become anti-establishment. And I thought, well, there's no good. You can't go. go back from this. I remember I went to the 2016 convention in Philadelphia, Democratic convention, and you'd walk in and half the place is filled with anti-establishment people screaming their heads off, get corporate power, money out of politics, and let's have Medicare for all. And it was unbelievable. And that's all gone. I went to the last one, and it was like going to a Stepford convention, right? There was everybody was there just.
And they banned Hassan Piker for whatever reason because he was.
Did they?
Yeah, they kicked him out.
They're just repeating. Everybody just repeating establishment talk. Go along, and I'm like, does it bother you that they didn't have? I would have asked delegates. Did it bother you that they didn't have a primary? No, they had a process, and I'm like, oh my God. So there's no. There's no adversary here. There's nobody pushing back here at all. No, they're all, you know, speaking,
a bunch of sheep.
Reading from the same songbook. You know, it was just weird. So I thought, and to juxtapose that against the 2016 convention, it was just mind blowing. I mean, there were people. They had to put sound cannons on us at the convention in 2016 and turn the lights off and try to shut us. I mean, it was raucous. It was rough. And I thought there's no turning back. Well, there was, because Bernie Sanders just tucked his tail and went along with the establishment, and he did it twice, which makes me 100% believe that he's just there. He's a psyop. He's there to make sure that. All the revolutionary energy on the left is funneled right back into an anti-worker, pro-war party.
It's a release valve of sorts, because I made this tweet.
And they're still like that. AOC and him are still there.
They're on the anti-oligarchy tour.
They weren't against oligarchs. You know, there were more billionaires donated to Joe Biden than Donald Trump. More billionaires donated to Kamala Harris than Donald Trump. So, but now they're against oligarchs.
And
now,
but then in 2 years they're going to tell you. In 2 years they're going to tell you. You know, in order to save democracy, you got to vote for Gavin Newsom.
That's right. Of course.
That's what's going to happen.
Of course, democracy's on the ballot. You guys didn't even have democracy in your primary. They didn't have, the Democrats haven't had a real primary for 15 years, right? So in 2016, they rigged it. Everybody knows. 2020, they stole it again from Bernie Sanders. They all colluded, got together after before Super Tuesday, or was it after? Doesn't matter.
Right before.
And they made sure Elizabeth Warren stayed in to split the progressive. And they got Joe Biden, who nobody wanted. They just forced him on it. And then in 2024, they didn't even have a primary. They just installed Kamala Harris. So that's...
You can see that lost in the election, because RFK was running in that primary, and then he ended up joining the Republicans. I think it moved enough votes to Trump.
Well, yeah. I was an RFK. Yeah. That's who I wanted, right? And so I felt like that was a big mistake of the Democrats. They could have brought him on, brought all the independents. They kicked him to the curb, and Trump, you know,
he's like,
smartly picked him up. And I think that did it. But anybody you have your eye on for that you think would be good, or
just Jimmy Dore?
No, I don't.
Jimmy Dore 2020.
I mean, I like Thomas Massie's courage and his sincerity. I don't agree with all his politics, but I like that he's refreshing in a sense that I feel like he's maybe the one guy that I can trust, or not that I want to trust a politician, but that I feel like he's sincere when he talks, and that he makes sure he's not bought and paid for. I feel like he's maybe the one guy who's not bought and paid for.
Yeah.
But that's like one guy.
But nobody on the Democrat side, huh?
No. Can you think of anybody?
No.
Not really. I mean, you'd say, oh, Ro Khanna's out there saying some stuff. Oh, but I think Ro Khanna is like a Silicon Valley.
Ro Khanna's a Russiagator.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
He's one of those guys, you know, he was before the Ukraine war. And when Max Blumenthal asked him about it, he accused Max Blumenthal of being paid by the Russians.
Right.
So that's just a scumbag. I'm sorry.
No, I'm not.
And, every once in a while, Ro Khanna say the right things and get behind the right piece of legislation. That doesn't mean he's not. You know, they're all politicians, right? So keep that in mind. So I made the mistake of thinking, oh, Ro Khanna's a good guy. And then I'm like, oh, no, he's just a fucking self-serving, self-dealing politician like all of them. And, you know, like, but as Frederick Douglass says, I'll join with anyone to do good and nobody to do bad. So if Ro Khanna has a good idea to stop the genocide in Gaza, I'll support him. You know, if he has an idea to stop the war in Ukraine, if he has an idea to cut the Pentagon budget, that's real. I'll join. So I'll join with anybody to do good and nobody to do bad, because, you know, that's what politics is. It doesn't, you know, it's like you don't want to see how it's made. All that matters is that's how they call it making the sausage, because it's a gross process. All that matters is the outcome in politics, right? So it doesn't matter. And what am I going to do if Donald Trump wanted to end the genocide? I'd support him.
Absolutely.
If he wanted to take the $200 billion he's giving to the Pentagon to increase the surveillance state and instead give it to affordable housing and drug treatment centers and mental health facilities that we don't have, I would support him. So I'm more about policy than about people.
Yeah, I think that's the message of hope for me, is if we could break out of the tribalism, the team sport politics, that's the only way we could really save
But the establishment, that's why the establishment makes sure that there's team sports and politics, and that, you know, the Republicans, they all think, well, if we can't let the Democrats take over again. And the Democrats say, we can't let Trump. And it's the same thing. It's like, no, they all work for the same people. They're all those billionaires, you know, the Mark Andre, the Peter Thiels, the Andreessens, the George Soros, they all work together. Right. Jeff Bezos, the Mark Zuckerberg, they all have Bill Gates. They all have shared interests, common interests, and they all work together behind the scenes. And then they pick their Democrat and Republican politicians to go control. And that's why we're at where we are. And Joe Biden had 4 years to get money out of politics. Didn't happen. The Democrats don't bring it up at all anymore, right? I mean, Bernie Sanders might still, but that's just to keep, like I said, to keep the revolutionary energy on the left
from breaking off,
funneled back into the Democratic Party, into the two-party system.
Yeah, I don't want to get, because I think we're at time, but the one other thing to support that, do you remember the Uncommitted movement right before?
Yeah.
That was funded by the DNC to not have them vote for a third party.
Oh.
To keep them within the Democratic Party.
So there you go.
You keep them uncommitted. Because if they didn't, they would have gone Jill Stein green. And they said, no, we don't want that. So we'll make a new uncommitted movement. And that was funded by the DNC.
Don't you think it's weird that Jill Stein has never had to answer for setting up Cornel West with Peter Dow? Isn't that funny?
I don't know what happened there.
I don't know. Sounds like somebody got to Jill Stein.
Well, we'll have to investigate that.
But she used to be a favorite on my show. She would always come on to send me DMs. I want to come on your show. We were supporters of hers, and then
something happened.
And then silence.
Oh, really? So
Oh yeah.
Wow.
She wouldn't come on my show. She wouldn't. Oh. That was. I'm like, you're kidding. I was your media outlet in 2016.
Yeah.
I was the one giving you. You know, I was the one helping you fight back against the morons like John Oliver saying you can't vote for a third party because they're crazy.
Wow.
Remember that? Do you remember that?
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I remember John Oliver saying that.
And John Oliver's another release valve, right? He sometimes says the right thing, and then when the time comes, he's like, "You got to back in."
That's right. Yeah.
So, if people want an honest, unfiltered point of view, they can follow you where? Do you have any shows coming up? Tell us about all your stuff.
Oh yeah. So, my tour, I'll be in Rutherford, New Jersey. Manhattan's already sold out. Then we go to Canada. We go to Calgary, Vancouver, Edmonton. And then Appleton, Wisconsin, Chicago, Illinois, South Bend? Fort Wayne, Indiana, Louisville, Kentucky. So I'll see you there. Upcoming dates.
Don't go fishing in Canada while you're there.
I love
maybe
Canada.
Do.
I love Canada. I have a big following in Canada. Everywhere I go, sells out.
Amazing.
I get to play some of the prettiest theaters in Montreal. We just did Montreal, Toronto, and Ottawa. And I didn't know how that was going to go. I'd never been to Montreal before. I'd never been to Ottawa. It was amazing. It was sold out, these beautiful theaters. I can't believe it. I have to pinch myself. Like, this is me? It's really crazy.
I mean, you are the American dream, right? And you are living your dream. So I'm so grateful that you came on. We're both so grateful. It was so awesome to talk to you. And we're going to have to go to one of the shows.
We have to go to the show. And you'll find, I mean, travel, like, people are awesome everywhere. It's the people in charge who are just fucked up and
that's right.
Everything.
True.
And I actually have a special coming out soon. Ooh. Either maybe this weekend, maybe next weekend. I filmed it at Joe Rogan's club.
Oh, the comedy.
I was just there last week.
Oh, no
I
kidding.
I went to a Kill Tony.
Oh, those are great. Yeah.
It's so funny.
So it's called, my new special is called Grab 'Em by the Pussy.
I love it.
And
we'll be looking forward to that.
So hopefully people will check it out. I'll be dropping clips on.
And where can they check it out?
JimmyDore.com, okay. But I haven't released it yet. So
okay.
I'm going to release clips on YouTube, right? You know, like maybe 10-minute increments. And then you can go back to JimmyDore.com to watch the full special for $10, which I think is...
That's a Starbucks these days.
I got to try to recoup my costs on that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to be paying for it and watching it. So I'm excited.
Okay, fantastic. I appreciate that, Danny.
Yes. Yeah. And thank you, everybody, for helping launch this show. I know the Patreon members are amazing for helping get... I mean, starting a show is so difficult. I didn't realize this. Just the going from like Instagram, you know, on your phone to like a full show, it really takes a lot. So we appreciate you guys for making this happen, for allowing to happen. So sign up for the Patreon. This will be available before YouTube on Patreon. So really appreciate you
guys'
support.
Our founding fathers, thank you so much.
Absolutely. And we'll see you guys next time. Appreciate it.
Bye.
Today-ish.